Welcome to the Cool Tools Show. I'm Mark Frauenfelder, Editor-in-Chief of Cool Tools, a website of tool recommendations written by our readers. You can find us at cool-tools.org. I'm joined by my co-host, Kevin Kelly, founder of Cool Tools. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, it's great to be here.
In each episode of the Cool Tools Show, Kevin and I talk to a guest about some of his or her favorite uncommon and uncommonly good tools they think others should know about. Our guest this week is Rob Beskiza, an editor at Boing Boing and creator of Text.fyi, various half-baked video games, and other internet-based distractions. Hey, Rob, how's it going?
It's going great, Mark. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Yeah, we're really glad to have you back on the podcast. We've had you before, and we're looking forward to your cool tools.
Great. I'm looking forward to telling you about them.
Yeah, Rob, you're a very self-entertained person. You're you're like an incredible artist. You are a coder. You are a musician. You make videos. So I imagine that this lockdown is not really irking you as much as other people.
Well, I don't know. It kind of catches up on you, I think. Even if you think you're someone who benefits from isolation, seeing other people suffer from it, seeing everything around you and other people in isolation around you who are not used to that kind of environment, who need other people to thrive, I think it does start to get to you after a while. And we're all kind of in that situation, I think.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely a good point. Rob, you have some great tools to talk about this time. Why don't you tell us about your angled desktop drawing board?
This is one of those things that a lot of self-taught artists don't even know about, but is a huge benefit when they figure it out. And this is just one of those angled things you put on your desk that means that whatever you're working on, it doesn't have to be artwork. It could be anything. It could even just be writing. It could be the just typing or anything that angles it so that it's looking at you instead of up at the ceiling.
To describe it for people who don't know, it's sort of something that you can place on top of your desk that will make another surface that will angle up, and you can adjust the angle, any angle that
exactly.
You want, and you can have a book, or you can read, you can write, you can draw on this surface, which is now angled at your preferred angle.
Exactly. I'd never even thought of this until I kind of chanced across it a couple of years ago.
Is there a particular model or version of this that you like more than others?
There's basically two types you can get. There's like the $100 type and there's the $25 type. The $100 type will have these tension cables and bars across it, which means that you can hold artwork in place while you work on it. And then there's the $25 types that you can get from Amazon or Dick Blick or anywhere else, where it's just a piece of wood with a bar that means that you can pick the angle that it's at and leave it there. And I actually prefer the cheap ones because they usually come with a little drawer underneath them where you can stuff paint and pencils and markers or what have you. Whereas the fancier ones, it's something that doesn't really have any features beyond the technical stuff, which they're very nice for and they have a smoother surface. And the big thing for artists, I think, is that it means that you don't end up with a distorted perspective of your work. You can go for years, like I went for years without realizing that I was always fighting a perspective problem when I was drawing or painting on a normal desk surface. And it's something that you bake into your work without even thinking about it. You account for it. But it means that you're always working against, you're always trying to account for something that you don't even realize is happening, which is that you're drawing at an angle or you're painting at an angle. As soon as you put it at a better angle, an angle facing you on one of these surfaces, suddenly it's like everything just becomes just that little bit easier, just a little bit less thinking, a little bit less mental overhead to the work. And it really makes a difference. It's it's one of those things, like, I was formally trained as an artist when I was a teenager by an old guy who wanted everyone to use oil paints, and I hated it. I so hated using man, the word has escaped my mind right now because I hate them so much. An easel. I so hated using easels that I never imagined that having a little one on my desktop would be a good idea for anything at all, because I so associated it with smelly, greasy, slow-drying paint.
You suggested an idea to me, which is, like, if you have a Wacom tablet, that you might want to even have a tablet sit at an angle as well.
Yeah, that's what I use day in, day out. It's just a standard Intuos tablet, and that's what I've got on it. It's like, I'm going to send you guys a photograph of the thing I made. I made one just for my Intuos. So it's like this tiny little wooden angle that the Intuos sits on, so I can use it while I'm looking at the screen, and it's great.
That's so cool.
One of the smaller ones from Amazon, probably the $25 models, would be great just for an Intuos, and you can use it with Photoshop or anything else.
Cool.
That sounds fantastic. And what about, like, back strain? And like, my 22-year-old daughter is an art student, and she has one of these she just pops it on her desk and it's at an angle. And for her, it was like a huge difference in not having to hunch over, and it's relieved her back problems. Is that another reason that you use it?
You know, it hasn't been something that's come up for me, but I think that's probably an obvious quality to it, is when you're hunched over the desk, when the perspective is unnatural, you're going to sit there without even realizing it, hunching forward to try and look at it from above. And that can't be a good posture. It can't be relaxing, even if you're accustomed to doing it. And one of the things I saw recently was older artists, especially comic book artists, people who have to do a lot of work, long hours, just to keep up, that they experience those kind of issues, repetitive strain issues, posture issues, more so than everyday workers. So I think that if you're an artist and you work and you're doing those kind of 10-hour, 16-hour days, and you've never tried an angled surface, it's absolutely the best thing you could do for yourself, just to rule it out.
Have you tried experimenting with the different angles, and have you found, like, say, this Wacom tablet, which I have you found one angle to be better than another angle, or do you keep adjusting the angles to keep it changing?
You know, I haven't. I'm just looking at the one I made. I remember using it. I think it's about 35%, about 35 degree angle. Sorry, not so I think that's probably a good one. I think the angle is always going to be sharper than you think. The closer it is to you looking straight at the art or the work, the better. And the chances are that's probably a quite steep angle. Like, I'm just looking at the product shots on Amazon, and they show them at a very low angle, almost like maybe 15 or 20%. But I think that the getting one that can go to a quite high angle, up to 45% maybe, is probably a better idea.
Does it help to elevate it?
I don't know. It's like, I remember I never used to like standing at an easel, but I quite like sitting at a desk. Mm-hmm. Having that kind of surface in front of me. Like, one of the problems with desks is desks are usually too high. Desks are usually about 30 inches off the ground, which is too high for most people, but we get used to it. So I think a lot of people may even have tried something like this, and they won't have liked it because it adds another 2 or 3 inches just to, like, the basic height of the desk. So if you can, like, sit on a cushion and see if that changes things, if you have trouble with it.
Okay, that's really good to know. Okay, thanks, Rob. So there's one for $27 on Amazon, they're quite affordable. So the next one is a toaster oven that you are a fan of.
Yes, this is the Panasonic Flash Express And there's a complicated model number that comes next, but I don't think you need it. You'll find it with that. I work from home. I work in the basement. So, and since I've got a young toddler, I like, you know, you get to the point where you have to avoid going up during the day, because otherwise you'll get distracted by the toddler and you won't do work for 3 hours. So to avoid this, I got a toaster oven. So whenever I wanted a snack, I would just throw something in the toaster oven. But the problem with toaster ovens is they're all garbage. They're horrible gadgets. And they're really bad. Like, if you just go into Best Buy or Home Depot or whatever and buy a toaster oven, it'll be the worst thing you've ever bought, except for a printer. So, but the thing about the Panasonic Flash Express is it's really weird, at least by the boring, everyday, well-marketed standards of Western appliances. This is like a Japanese-style appliance where it's very small, it's very powerful, it gets dangerously hot. Like, you shouldn't put anything on it. You can literally toast. I toast bread on the top of it whilst I'm cooking inside it. It's that hot. And it has very simple, but slightly unusual controls, which take a bit of getting used to, but which are clearly, you know, it looks very much, it's very much like a Japanese appliance from the 80s. It has.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It reminds me of like one of those Sony monitors, like a professional like editing monitor or something.
Yeah, this is like a professional editing toaster oven. That's exactly what it is. It's really great. And it isn't expensive. They're about $80. You can get them on Amazon. And I think one of the big retailers carries them. It might be Best Buy. We can look that up. And the only thing about it is it's really small. I guess it's designed for kitchens in smaller apartments. And I kind of wish it was a bit bigger, but I really like it. It makes great toast. Every challenge, like for example, I needed soda ash for a project. So I just threw in some sodium bicarbonate on its tray. And 2 hours later, I have a pile of soda ash. It's just really versatile, basic, straightforward. You can't, you know, the only bad thing about it is it's so small, I don't think it's user serviceable. When those infrared light bulbs go, I have a feeling that you just have to buy a new one.
I see. Yeah. And that's what's heating it? They're actually infrared light bulbs? Not
well, that's
oil?
What they call them. I think that they're just like really hot halogen light bulbs, I think.
I see. But, okay. Mm-hmm. It seems like the Panasonic Flash Express compact toaster is, along with toilet paper and dishwashing detergent, currently unavailable, and nobody has any idea when it'll be available, back in stock.
So that's sad.
But you can.
If you can't find them on Amazon, I did get mine locally. I can't remember where. It might be Home Depot. It might be Lowe's. It might be Best Buy. One of those places does carry them, so you can actually walk out the house and get one.
Yeah,
I'm seeing that the white model is available. It's the silver one and the black one that are sold out.
Alrighty, okay, good.
They're really cool. But Rob, before we move to the next tool, can you tell me what you use the soda ash for?
Dyeing, as in fiber reactive dyeing of cellulose fibers.
So you were cool. So you're dyeing clothes or some other kind of fabric?
Yeah. Well, so it's like you mentioned that I do lots of different things. Mm-hmm. But the problem is most of them are monetizable. So in some small way, music, video games, blogging, all of it, you can wrap ads around or something and you make money from it. So I like to have a hobby where there's just no way you can make any kind of money or attention from it. Just so that you can zen out and do something creative and not be distracted by the prospect of attention or money. And dying is good because no one cares about your, you know, no one cares about a custom made pink True Religion jacket or whatever. So
I don't know about that, Rob. You put it on Etsy. There's going to be people who want it, especially if you do it.
Well, that's the idea. I found something which where you know it doesn't take a lot of effort to become competent at it. It's like painting bookshelves. You know, there's just only so much. Famous last words like, I'm going to have Reddit's painting bookshelves subreddit all over me now. But there are just certain things that you just don't need to be any good at anything to be competent at, you know, to get the results you want.
Yeah. Moving on to the next one, Rob, tell us about this this cool looking rotary hammer drill.
So this is the Bosch Bulldog Extreme. And so here's the thing. When people buy drills, like little power drills or whatever, for use around the house or for projects, the chances are they're going to do a bit of research and they're going to get like an 18-volt cordless drill. And that's fine. But I'm here to tell you, you should do something a bit more than this. And here's the problem with those 18-volt drills. Most of them are too big and heavy to be fun and easy to use, but they're not big and heavy enough for the big jobs that you will probably have. I mean, you can do anything with like white wood with them, but if you have masonry walls or metal, the chances are it's just not going to be enough. So after years of doing stuff with an 18-volt drill and being frustrated or tired by it, I realized that it was better for the small jobs just to get a little 12-volt drill. And there's all sorts of decent ones. But for the big jobs, you want something which can really just cut through the walls like butter. And that's why a full-size SDS hammer drill is really the thing you want. Like it's I talk about working in a basement, the walls are like foot thick concrete. Putting up pictures, making it habitable was just such slow going with an 18 volt drill. But now I just glide through that cement in seconds because I have a proper grown up tool.
What does SDS mean?
If you imagine a drill, the part of the drill bit that goes into the tool, SDS is protocol because my head is full of computers, but it's just like flutes fluting down the side so that instead of just a circle that might slip or which doesn't have enough power to get through something really tough, it grabs like a screwdriver head.
So it's like a hexagonal shank rather than a cylindrical shank.
Yeah, it's the next thing up from hexagonal. It's got like teeth into it. It's almost like a plus shaped bit.
The drill bits would come with that kind of a shank.
Yes, like if you go into a big box store or buy on Amazon and type SDS, the bits will be like a bit more expensive, but they come with, you know, you can see that they're a bit beefier.
And that shank is there because there's such torque on the drill bit itself that if you're just gripping it with the pressure of like a normal chuck, it's not going to grab. You need these extra indentations in the shank in order to really hold it as it spins.
Yeah, it makes a huge difference. For example, with my 18-volt drill, the one I never use now, going into the old cement walls, just to put up a picture, I just want an inch deep, 3/16 hole. It would take maybe 2 minutes with a standard decent drill bit. But with this, like a full-size hammer drill, it's corded, but you can get them battery powered. With an SDS bit, it's like zoom, it just goes right in. It's done. It's in a moment. It casts my mind back to when I've just sat there with the Ryobi 18 volt drill grinding away at the wall just so I can put up a damned picture.
Rob, what's the hammer? Is it actually hammering as well? Is it like
an impact
driver? Drill? A driver? Is it also hammering it?
Yeah, that you can switch it on and off. Like if you, like if you're just kind of trying to put something in drywall and you have it in the hammer drill mode, you're just going to go like you get your whole body is just going to fly through the wall. So you can turn the hammer off and kind of use it sensibly if it's for a smaller job. I mean, you look at this thing. I mean, if you look at this thing on the internet, it will be, you'll see that it's almost like a jackhammer. It's like 2 foot long. But if you do anything above putting wall pictures up on drywall, if you've ever had the slightest frustration with like your basic 18 volt Christmas gift drill, just go out and get one. They're $120. It's not going to kill you, and you'll have so much fun.
You'll find all kinds
and
of things.
You could. They're strong enough. If you have like the basement, it's 100-year-old. It's just a rat slab, 2 inches thick. You can get a jackhammer style bit and put it in there, and it'll go through it. Not as quickly as a jackhammer, but it's an extremely powerful, versatile tool. But it's just above the level where most people would think of buying, if you see what I'm getting at. It looks kind of dangerous and professional. It's not. It's cool. It's fun. Just go buy one.
Did you get the dust attachment with it?
No, that would be a really good idea because especially if you're grinding into cement or if you've got something like anything, you know, a lot of the things you do with it will probably kick up dust, and dust is bad.
Yeah. It looks like a good thing. So the hammer on its own is like on Amazon anyway, $160, and then you can get like a kind of a light duty dust attachment. It would be a total of $200, or if you want the heavy duty dust attachment, you're paying around $220. So it's not like super expensive. And it sounds like if you were going to be doing, like you said, more than just drilling holes in the drywall, this thing is going to be really useful.
Yes, definitely. If you're going anywhere near masonry, just get one. It will make all the difference.
That sounds good. So, Rob, your fourth tool is an old corded office phone. Is that what we're talking to you?
Yes. An old corded office phone has rescued this very podcast.
It has indeed. Yeah, right. We had trouble with the microphone and your computer and stuff, so we finally just said, call in, and that's what we're talking to you.
And the magic here is really, you know, I don't know how to put it. Maybe it's a spiritual thing, but just having a phone on the desk where I can punch the numbers and see without having to take the phone off of my head. I know that there are other ways to do that, but I just find it comforting that I have a phone in front of me where I can hit the button to record it, and the phone records the call instead of relying on some rigmarole with Google Voice or whatever to record the call. I can hit numbers without, I don't know. It's very difficult to explain, I think, because I'm maybe a sign of age, but after 10 or 15 years of just using cell phones to have a standard desk phone, I found it made everything a bit less stressful, a bit easier to do. It puts it a certain remove, and it separates a certain kind of work. Like especially if I'm calling someone to get quotes for a story or whatever, it separates that from the fun things I use a phone for.
So you know, Brian Eno has this kind of a term. I'm not sure it's his term. He uses called calm technology. And calm technology, one of the attributes of calm technology is that there is very little interaction. So it's like there's technology that's kind of there, and it's you use it with a minimal of interaction. It's like a mirror on the wall. You interact with it, but you don't have to do anything to interact. You're just there. And the advantage of this kind of phone sitting there is that there's a minimal amount of interaction. You call on it, but there's nothing else that you have to kind of set up or I think it's the minimal interaction is maybe part of what you're trying to put your finger on, that it has sort of a, maybe a single function, The interface is very, very minimal because you just use it. It's just there. You pick it up. Maybe that's the interaction. You pick it up and you speak into it. So there is a kind of a counterpart to all the complexity that we have with our desktop interfaces and everything else, is you have this other thing there that is a minimal interaction, and it's kind of evident also. It's obvious how you interact with it, and there's an attraction to that.
Yes, it's a division in labor. It's definitely got a quality. I like that phrase. Brian Eno, did you say? Calm technology.
Calm technology, yeah. There was a guy recently who made, he used an e-ink screen the size of the front page of the New York Times to have an e-ink pane on his wall that was only, that only showed the front page of the New York Times, and it would change every day. And you, that's all you could do with it. You could just walk over and read the New York Times front page on that. And it was reflected light rather than transmitted light. So it had a calming effect because it was sort of picking up the colors of the room. It was, it wasn't doing something itself. It was kind of just reflecting it in a kind of a weird way. And so yes, that had a calming, it had a kind of a calming effect. It's kind of like, I don't know, maybe McLuhan's hot and cold technology. There was a sense of which it was cool and calm.
Yeah, it's not sat there glowing.
Right. It's not emitting, sending things out. It's sort of there, and it's passive in a certain sense.
Right.
And maybe your landline phone has some of that quality. And but what's really interesting, we had one in our home that just last month I finally got rid of, because unfortunately it would ring all the time and it was always spam.
That's
the only calls we were getting on our landline were spam, and so we just never answered it anymore. And I mean, I think that the telephone companies have just done them a huge disfavor on not just eliminating spam, which they could do, just like Google, you know, Gmail does. They just filter out. They know what the spam is. Mm-hmm. And they could eliminate it, but because they would not, I wound up surrendering the landline because I just couldn't stand the spam calls anymore.
Yeah, they never stop. So Rob, in the couple of minutes we have left, I just wanted to get from you, the first time we had you on, it was kind of around the time when you had released text.fyi to the world.
Yeah.
And so it's been going on for a while. I'm just curious to see, are people using it? Are they using it for interesting things that you didn't expect them to be using? Maybe just start by saying what it is and how people are using it.
TextFYI is a publishing platform, the simplest possible publishing platform. You just go there, you type in a box and publish it. You don't need to log in. It does some basic spam detection, but it's not very good, and I'll get to that in a minute. And everything goes up. There's no way to search for it. It's by default, it's just there at a certain URL. And if you want it to stay private, it stays private. Some people use it as like a paste bin type thing. But one of the things that I thought was really good was people use it to write letters to themselves, notes. They use it for all sorts of reasons, and they presumably have their own organizational systems themselves, because it doesn't provide anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that was interesting about it is because there's no way to search, there's no way to tag other people, it's completely anonymous. I wondered whether people would abuse it. You'd think that something where anyone can just use it without logging in would become an instant sewer. And it didn't. For 2 years, there was no spam or very little spam, no abuse. There was just no mechanism for it to be put to nefarious use. But that changed recently. And I think at this point, I have to do something about it. And it's being used by Facebook spammers. And what they do is they host they put links on there. as part of their chain of scamming people. And they direct message people on Facebook with those links, or they start groups on Facebook, which are scam groups that pretend, usually to pretend to be a charity being operated by the boxer Floyd Mayweather. Mm-hmm. And the scam links they post to Facebook will go to TextFYI, and TextFYI will have the real scam link that Facebook would block.
Interesting.
That then kicks them on. And it's very frustrating because the only thing which is ruining this or making it difficult or pointless to operate it is Facebook. Facebook does nothing whatsoever when you complain about the scam groups. They do not ban the scam users. You'd think they would just ban TextFYI, but they don't do that either. They just don't care at all. And what really surprises me is what might be a lesson for other people is if you do a small public-facing internet project which in some way depends upon the good faith of users, that might work even now, even with how bad things are on the internet, but for Facebook. Facebook will find a way to make it a hostile place. And I think interesting and it upsets me.
So one of the interesting things about that is that this is an issue that affects people on Facebook who get affected by the spam because they go there and then they click the link, so they go somewhere where it's probably not a good idea to go. But for users of TextFYI who are good users, there's no cross pollution for them or anything. They're just seeing this nice clean interface. And for me, when I use it, that spamming thing's never going to be a problem unless it like overloaded your server or something.
It's only going to be a problem for Facebook users who join the Floyd Mayweather charity group thinking that they can, I don't know why people do that. I mean, it's like spam. Like, how does that even work on people? But it does.
Yeah.
And there are people who just join every Floyd Mayweather group and they get private messaged by the scammer running it. And this, it's horrible that they track me. And here's the thing: this is why I'm going to have to turn it off. Is they don't get angry. They track me down in person and send me their bank details, so that I can send them the money that they think they're getting.
Oh my God!
We talk about that's the thing. When people joke about how spam reaches people who are easy marks for spam, you have no idea. If you spent a weekend just as a spammer and just sent out all those spammy emails that everyone just thinks, oh, how does anyone fall for that? You will get people emailing you their bank details. It's crazy how stupid they are. And I know that there's an element of privilege in that. Like, I don't know what people, how desperate people are.
Yeah.
Where they're from, but it just just be under no illusions about how easy it is to grift people on the internet.
Do you think there's a way you could, and maybe this would overcome, make it too complicated, but like charge a penny for every time someone publishes something on TextFYI?
What I'm going to do is I'm just going to block Facebook as a referrer. If you try and go there from Facebook, it will just not let you go there.
Oh, that's good.
I think that's the easiest way to deal with it. Like, you can't do that. I mean, most people, that's the last thing they want to do is block people from Facebook. Like, imagine if we blocked people from Facebook on Boing Boing.
Right.
You know, it would be impossible.
Yeah.
TextFYI doesn't make any money, so that's not the point. So I can do that, but it's depressing. It's depressing to even have to do that.
Well, I mean, that's the story of the internet, of things that worked really well until the spammers came along, and then they just break it, and it's again and again and again. It's a long story of things that were just beautiful until people figured out how to scam it or whatever, and it's a very small percent, but man, they alter the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
You have to do all kinds of silly things.
Yeah.
just because of, you know, maybe it's 10 people or who knows. It's
like the Garden of Eden story over and over again.
Yeah, just, well, I'm not sure they had spammers, but I don't know what the equivalent would be.
Aren't spammers kind of snakish in a way?
Okay. All right.
I do think it's good, though, that right now, like now, after everything that the internet has been through, the web has been through the last 5 to 6 years, to be able to put something in the internet where no credentials are required to use it. And I'm not far from the only person doing this. Lots of people are doing this. They're proving that it's possible and that it can be done without it being destroyed by abusive, hostile, harassing behavior. Mm-hmm. And I think that the important thing to draw from that is that kind of behavior is not intrinsic to the internet. It's a side effect of the way sites, social media like Facebook and Twitter is designed.
I think you're absolutely right. You put a ton of thought into this, and this simplicity is deceptive. You made it so that people who use it are not going to be subject to spam or harassment or trolling or any of that. It's just like an incredibly useful tool. And I use it, the way I use it is if I want to show something that I on Twitter and I want to bypass the whatever it is, 280 character limit or whatever it is now, I'll just link something to text.fyi that I wrote, and there it is.
Great. Yeah, I like that. And the only drawback of that is it then becomes searchable within Twitter. But I guess if you were posting it to Twitter, you don't mind that.
Yeah, I don't mind that. I want them to see it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, cool, Rob. This has been great. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us, and thanks for putting up with the technical glitches we experienced earlier.
My fault.
No. So, Rob, do you have a place where people who are interested in finding out more about all your creative endeavors can go?
You know what? I think there's my website at biskitza.com, but it's years out of date like everyone's is. Mm-hmm. So I would just say just go to Boing Boing and read everything there, and the stuff I do gets posted there and along with everything else. So.
That sounds great. Rob, thank you so much.
All right, yeah, guys. Thank you.
Really enjoyed it.
Hey, everybody, it's your host, Mark, and I wanted to thank you for listening to the Cool Tools Show. And I also wanted to let you know that we've got a lot more going on at Cool Tools than just this podcast. We also have the Cool Tools website, which has a new tool review every day, and you can get there by going to cool-tools.org. We also have 4 different newsletters that you can subscribe to, and you can subscribe to those from the Cool Tools page. We have this podcast that you're listening to right now. We also have a YouTube channel where we review tools. Check that YouTube channel out by going to youtube.com/cooltools. And one of the things I'd like to ask you is if you're really enjoying everything that we are producing, go to our Patreon page and support us there. You can sign up and give us as little as $1 a month, and that would mean a lot to us. The money that we get from Patreon goes towards a lot of things. We transcribe our podcast interviews so that you can read them online. We pay for editing of our podcasts and for our videos. We pay our contributors. We have video production costs. We have equipment costs. We have hosting costs. And the money you give us through Patreon also goes to support Cool Tools Lab. Anything you give is a huge help. And one of the things that we do is if you are a contributor to Patreon, we'll give you a shout out on air. And so I have a few people here to thank this week. Mark Lyonage, Micah Gates, Monty Zukowski, Patrick James McNally, Robert Cohen, Scott, Spence Lloyd, Steve Avery, Steve Golden, Steve Levine, Tom Hess, William Phillips, Aaron Nipper, Dharab Patel, Glenn Mercer, Jay Walker, Jeff Bonair, Ryan Jarrell, Pat Daly, Patrick Kennedy, Troy Wallett, Mike Camerate, Nicole Harkin, Tim Youssef, Scott Reed. Thanks all of you for supporting Cool Tools. And if you would like to have a shout out, go over to the Patreon page and sign up. And thanks for listening to the Cool Tools podcast. We'll see you next week.